next part of the track. This was where the race acute senses picked up the single calls of encouragement, usually from teammates. Sometimes the idiotic suggestion called out by those who knew no better. Pick it up! Pick it up! There would be the occasional giggling or moronic teeny boppers who did not quite know what they were laughing about. But those were the peripheral toys of a frenzied mind. The real work of the shining orb was monitoring the steadily droning pakita pakita of a human body hurtling along at a constant 15-plus miles an hour. He walked through the far turn and up the straight to the starting post. Someone would be reading out times, probably around 57 or 58, assuming that no one went crazy during the first quarter. You'll hear the crowd again along here, he thought, particularly after we go through under 60. They won't be cheering for some goddamn Finn, but you'll hear them just the same. Whether a psychological thing or not, the second lap was when it always hit him, either right at the post or as they rounded the turn. The shocking enormity of the physical effort descended on him then, and he knew from there on in it would be pretty grim business. At this point, the carefully nurtured mental toughness tempered by hours of interval work would allow him to endure the shock to his system and race on. He would be ready for it, and he would know it was going to get far worse. He could be the best conditioned athlete in the world, but if his mind was not ready to accept the numbing wave at the start of the second lap, he would not even finish, much less hope to win. Cassidy walked through the turn and again into the lonely back straight. By this time, he would be concentrating on pace, not allowing himself to become frightened by the first hint of numbness and discomfort. It wouldn't be pain exactly, not at this point, but it would not be altogether pleasant either. It was here the pace might tend to slow, something he would have to watch, something he would damned well prevent if he had to. He would now go into his floating stride, the long ground eaters, and he would think to himself, cover territory. No one ever won a race on the second lap either, but plenty of people lost them there. This would be the time for covering distance with as little effort as possible. Through the far turn and into the home straight again, he tried for the feeling and thought he got it pretty well. Finally, around at the starting post again, he tried to get the awfulness of the start of the third lap, but could not. He had seen the drawn, haunted look on his own face in mid-race photographs, and still he could not get that feeling. It was contained there somewhere in the glistening orb, he knew, and would never get out. Denton was right about it. You could think about it all you want, but you couldn't feel it until you were there again. He knew only that here, at the halfway point, he would be once again in extremis. It would flabbergast him to think, so he would do so only for an instant, that he was only halfway through it. He would have run the first half mile faster than he could run a half mile flat out in high school, 159.2, and he would have a long way to go. He walked into the turn of the third lap. Here the real melancholy began, when the runner might ask himself just what in the hell he was doing to himself. It was time for the most intense concentration, the iciest resolve. It was here the leader might balk at the pain and allow the pace to lag, here that positions shifted. Those whose conditioning was not competitive would settle to the back of the pack to hang on. The kickers would move up like vultures to their vantage points at the shoulders of the front runners. It was a long, cruel lap with no distinguishing feature save the fact that it had to be run. Every miler knows, in the way a sailor knows the middle of the ocean, that it is not the first lap, but the third that is farthest from the finish line. Races are won or lost here, records broken or forfeited to history, careers made or ended. The third lap was a microcosm not of life, but of the bad times, the times to be gotten through. The no toys at Christmas sitting at the bus station at midnight blues times to look back on and try to laugh about or just forget. The third lap was to be endured and endured and endured. Cassidy reached the home straight again, thinking, No matter how bad it is, I can't let it lag here, whatever the cost. If I have to lead the whole mothering thing, I can't let it lag here. Then he was walking back by the post for what would be the gun lap. As soon as the pistol cracked, he would feel a tingling on the back of his neck, and the adrenaline would shoot through his system again. A quarter of a mile to go, and he would become a competitive athlete again, looking around to size up the situation, leaning a little into his stride, and once again, even through the numbing haze then gripping his body, feeling pride in his strength. Cassidy walked through the turn, pumping his arms a little, thinking of the nervous crowd noises as the pace began to pick up. Perhaps there would be only a small group left in it now. 3, 4 maybe. But they would all have ambitions. No one ever ran down the back straight of the gun lap with the leaders without thinking he had a shot at it. On Cassidy walked, along the lonely straight, imagining the bristling speed as the pace heated up. There would be some last-second evaluations, some positioning and repositioning, and then finally, the kicks, one by one or all at once, blasting away for the tightly drawn yarn across the finish line. Into the turn with only a 3:30 to go, everyone would be into it by then. Everyone still in contention. Walton was known to kick from more than a 4:40 out, so surely his hand would be on the table. Coming out of the final turn, just at the place Landy turned to look for the elusive banister, Cassidy walked into the final 1:10 straight and thought, "Here, as they say, it will be all over but the shouting. You will fight the inclination to lean backward. Fight to keep the integrity of the stride, not let over-eager limbs flail around trying to get more speed. Just run your best stride like you have trained 10,000 miles to do, and don't, for God's sake, let up here until the post is behind you. The die would be cast here, and no praying or cheering or cajoling or whimpering would change it." He had lost in this final straight before, but not as much as he had won here. Neither held much in the way of fear or surprise once you were there. Such matters, as Denton had often said, were settled much earlier, weeks, months, years before. They were settled on the training fields, on the 10-mile courses, on the morning workout missed here or made up there. Other than maintaining and leaning at the tape, Denton had told him, there is not much you can do about it. Heart has nothing to do with it. In the final straight, everyone has heart. Cassidy walked on past the finish line, across which someone would hold the taut yarn and blink as the runners flashed by. It was still more than 24 hours away, but standing there in the calm, anonymous night, 5 yards past the familiar white post, Quentin Cassidy knew at that instant the depth of his frenzied yearning to feel the soft white strand weaken and separate against his heaving chest. The demons were now in control. It no longer made him afraid. 36. The Race. The noise from the stadium carried out here, but Cassidy didn't pay much attention. He liked doing most of the warm-up ritual out on the cross-country course, where he could think. The routine itself was automatic. 4 miles easy, then long flowing striders, another mile easy, faster striders, then on with the spikes, some sprints on the track, then jog until time. It was the roar in his head he had to fight. It had to be contained, suppressed, released only in that slow crescendo of calculated frenzy that would crest when the pistol cracked and he unleashed it all. The orb now floated gently in his mind, glistening, peaceful, hard as spun steel. It would hold all grief, all despair, all the race woes of a body going to the edge. It would allow him to do what he had to do until there was nothing left. Yes, he had decided long ago it was better to get ready out here, where things were quieter, more normal, more like his everyday routine. Trying to warm up in the stadium, being close to the crowd, would make him jittery, causing the roar in his head to build in spurts, getting him there too early. It might upset the orb, and when the despair descended on him, he would have no place to put it. Or he might be in such a lunatic state as to turn the first 220 in 25 seconds out of sheer screaming hysteria. No, it was better out here, where it was quiet, where he could get ready in the same way he had done all the rest. It gave some comfort, this last bit of tranquility. He jogged slowly by the married student housing area, watching little children play under the trees. It was the eerie, almost magic post-dinner hour when time stands still for a child, when all existence floats in a cool, gray bath of dying day, and order is mercifully drawn from a chaotic infinity by a mother's come-home call. Erica! Jeremy! Two little figures scurried away in the shadows. He was getting farther and farther from the stadium, but he had plenty of time. Some other runners passed in pairs and threes, but no one spoke. One nodded at Cassidy, but looked puzzled. What would they be thinking about this bearded Finn with the ragged blonde hair? Would they think they recognized him from some track and field news photo? Cassidy jogged on. It was early May warm, and subtropical flowers ruled the air dizzily. The kind of evening so heavy with promise as to make him wonder if his life could ever be quite the same again as it was now, while he was so vital, so quick, so nearly immortal. While his speed and strength were such that he could be called out by only a handful of men on earth. Surely there could not be that many of us walking around like this, he thought. He felt a strange brand of nostalgia now that it was so close. A nostalgia for this moment, for the next hour. The present was so poignant he had begun to reminisce already. He thought of Michelangelo's David pondering the stone, David wondering too if life would ever be the same. He was about to go to the edge, had every bit of the wherewithal to get to the edge. The inevitability of his journey there was never far from his mind now. He knew that before too very long he would be in mortal distress. The time you won your town the race, we chaired you through the marketplace, he thought. Then a burst for 20 yards just to enjoy the sensation of sudden, unleashed speed. He felt both flushed and tired. That was common. You never really know how you feel, he thought, until the second lap. Sometimes not even then. Sometimes you don't even know until the last lap. The stiller town. When he reached Lake Alice, he slowed to a walk and then stopped altogether. He stretched out on the grass and did hurdles and butterflies. Stretching was always a pleasant indulgence. Then he undid the vertical zippers along the legs of his warm-ups and felt up and down both Achilles tendons. All the knots and lumps were gone. Soft trails, he thought. God damn Denton and those beautiful soft trails. He had made it through the winter okay, only 2 colds and no real injuries. He was a man without an alibi. 2 runners in Villanova sweats went by, but he didn't recognize either of them. From far off, the crowd yelled as someone cleared a height or broke the tape in a sprint preliminary, and his own body responded by dumping a shot of adrenaline into his system. He caught it quickly. Not yet, he thought. Not even close yet. It was a time for daydreams. The roar in his head was far off now and building, but it would grow on its own. The problem now was control. There had been a local race a long time ago, a 5-miler late in the summer. As the runner tooled along the bicycle path on the Palm Beach side of Lake Worth, he was sweating profusely. It flew off in arcs on every stride. True, he was not in very good shape yet, but it was far too early to worry about it. It was still summer and deathly hot. The child stopped him right in his tracks. It was about a mile after he had made the turn at the Sailfish Club. The kid could have been no more than 6 or 7, and as he walked toward the runner, it was apparent there was something wrong with him. He moved without flow, all angles and juts. The runner thought, he's so pale. But the child was just beaming. Wispy hair fell back into place as the hot wind blew through it. Clear blue eyes stared at Cassidy without fear or self-consciousness. Cassidy stood, gasping, dripping puddles of sweat onto the asphalt. He tried his best to beam back. Through his gasping, he couldn't help chuckling at how silly this was.
"Hello," Cassidy said.
"Hello," the child said happily. "What are you doing?"
"I'm running a race. What's your name?"
"Alan."
The child laughed, put a small hand to his mouth, so thin as to seem transparent. The runner looked over his little legs for braces, but saw none. The left shoe, however, seemed bulkier on the bottom than the other.
"A race?"
The child laughed again, obviously wary of being teased.
"But where are your oponuts?"
He said it, "oponuts."
"Oh,"
the runner gestured back toward the sailfish club. "They'll be right along." The child cocked his head in a very curious, nearly feminine manner, but he was still beaming.
"You," he said, "run like a big cat."
The runner swallowed. "You," Cassidy said, "are the finest fellow I have run across all morning, Alan. And I guess I'd better be getting along before my oponuts come along."
"Goodbye, big cat."
"Goodbye, Alan."
As he slipped off and gathered speed, he looked behind every few yards to see the child still watching. Finally, he disappeared behind a curve of high hibiscus a quarter of a mile down toward the bridge. "Wonder what he will think when the rest of them come clomping along," he thought. And although he really wasn't in very good shape yet, he turned a 4:45 for the last mile, changed from his racing flats, and jogged across the bridge toward home before the rest of them got in. If there was a medal or something, they would just have to mail it to him. For a long time after that, he wondered what it was about that child. A shriek from the stadium brought him back. He braked his wildly skittering heart. Cassidy swooped into a strider, held it until the speed built to racing pace, held it, then eased off, slowed to a stride, then a jog, and finally to a walk 100 yards away. He was on the flat grass in the field across the street from the stadium. Other athletes flashed by in blurs of color. He allowed himself some excitement on one of the striders and instantly felt the goosebumps on the back of his neck. He hadn't ever had it quite this bad before. The noise from the stadium across the street added to the growing roar in his head, but it didn't matter now. It was all right now. He allowed it to come, let it fuel his stride as he started up, slipped into it, and then built up speed until his legs seemed to come detached from him, and he flew along without conscious effort. Other athletes were at it too, nervous, casting furtive glances at one another, never looking anyone in the eye. A lot of people talk themselves right out of races now, Cassidy thought. He looked at his watch. 7:38. The mile was scheduled for 8:20, but they were running behind. Still, a few minutes later, he heard the call over the loudspeaker. "First call for the mile run." His heart twisted around in his chest like a wild animal. It was an absolutely wrenching shot of adrenaline. They were going to run it after all. He was going to have to go through with it. Then he got control again and steadied himself. Of course he was going to run this race. Take it easy. It was time to get into the infield and get used to being inside there. Do the last touch-ups. Put on the spikes. Ritual, ritual, ritual. Then the last sprints. The final psyching. "Jesus," he thought suddenly. "Why am I doing this? I ought to be in the 3 mile. I've been doing all that bulk work and everything. I can't possibly be ready for a mile." Then he steadied himself again. He thought of the last 2:20 the evening before and told himself, "Easy." He took a deep breath and walked over to pick up his bag. He had not spoken one word to anyone during the entire hour he had been out here. Runners flashed by. Everyone looked fast and fit as hell. Then he caught himself again. Any of these mothers runs 3:58 in a goddamn time trial in the dead of night, and he'll damned well deserve to eat my lunch. Again, he told himself, "Easy." Inside the stadium, a 178-pound lad who could bench press 300 pounds planted a 16-foot fiberglass pole in a tin box, inverted himself, and was tossed into the air a little more than 17 feet 8 inches. When the crowd reacted to this feat with a roar, something flipped in Quentin Cassidy. His heart jumped so hard he thought his head was going to pop right off. The tumult in his head was like the roar at the bottom of a waterfall. He walked to the competitor's entrance and, for a split second, had a rush of ordinary civilian panic as well. He had forgotten completely about this disguise business. But the little round face looked up from the clipboard, and the cold stump of cigar went round and round.
"Well, let's see here. 242. Why, I guess that would be you, Seppo. Go right on in there, boy, and you have yourself a good race, you hear? Say, that ain't true what they say about you Finn boys drinking reindeer milk, is it? Didn't think so."
Cassidy heard Brady Grapehouse cackling behind him as he went into the stadium. How the hell had Denton arranged that, he wondered. But then he was on the inside, and the special atmosphere, the blue-white lights, the wintergreen-laced, multicolored carnival that is a major track meet sent his senses reeling, just as it always did. "God," he thought, "here I am again. Here it all is, and here I am with everything on the line one more time." He looked back up track to make sure it was clear, and then jogged across the lanes to put his bag down. His heart skittered again, feeling for the first time in weeks the springy tartan beneath his feet. Officials were running here and there, hurdle setters scurrying around, timers checking watches. No one noticed the tall runner in robin's egg blue as he began the methodical jogging on the inside grass lane. The infield was a mass of motion. Javelin throwers were slogging back and forth in their strange sideways gait, hurling imaginary spears at their long-extinct enemies. Broad jumpers bounded around, high jumpers took their run-ups, and the runners of all sizes circled the track in various stages of their warm-ups. It made a three-ring circus look like a quilting bee.
"Second call for the mile run."
Flash went another shot of adrenaline through his veins. He took two gasping breaths that seemed wrenched from his body as if from one tossed suddenly into an icy sea. He got control again, this time with difficulty. Two laps, that's what the ritual called for. The roar inside his head drowned out the crowd altogether except when they went wild over some performance. But Quentin Cassidy noticed nothing. He moved inside his own box. His gaze was starting to take on the trance quality, so that when he ran by Denton without seeing him, the older runner was not in the least surprised.
"Seppo," he called out.
It took a while to register. But then, of course, it was all right. Denton would know an international runner. It would only be natural. Denton held out his hand when Cassidy circled back. He took it nervously. "Sorry," Cassidy said. "He here yet?" "Nope, but he will be. Best get your spikes on. How is it?" "Banjo string, E-flat." Denton nodded. "Bruce, I can hardly swallow." "It's okay. It'll be like all the rest once you get moving. Beforehand's tougher. I would jog with you, but I don't want to push our luck. Both Prigman and Doobie are here. Guess Walton's a big enough attraction to draw even the football establishment. Anyone say anything to you?" "No. Guess it's working. I'll be all right. I want to do it alone anyway." Denton noticed he was breathing fast, shallow, nearly gasping. It was not important, he knew, so long as he had not torn himself all up inside over it already. It would be all right soon. He gripped Cassidy by the elbow. Cassidy looked Denton in the eye very briefly, then smiled. He gripped Denton's forearm and held it hard for a moment. Then he turned and ran off down the track. "So," Denton thought. He had seen the look in Cassidy's eye. "So there it is after all." Cassidy finished the rest of the ritual lap. Then it would be off with the flats, on with the spikes, off with the damp T-shirt, on with the nylon racing singlet. Ritual, ritual, ritual. He had done it exactly this way hundreds of times. A roar came from the crowd that he did not understand. Nothing was going on with the field events, and they were between races on the track. Then he looked over at the competitor's entrance and understood. A knot had formed, a chancre of humanity around the gate that suddenly opened up and expelled in a burst the fastest miler in history. The crowd went crazy as he ambled easily across the track with a wan smile, giving the stands a little wave. But Cassidy could tell, even from where he stood, the kind of look in his eye as he glanced quickly around the stadium and with a shudder dropped his bag to tug up the zipper on his turtleneck warm-up. Little fluffs of hair on the back of Cassidy's neck went prickly again as Walton began his striders. He was nearly 2 inches shorter than Cassidy, but looked as if he could run through a wall. He already had his spikes on. Every eye in the place followed him as he began doing his sprints on the back straight. The black suit of New Zealand, Cassidy thought. The silver leaf. Bailey. Hallberg. Snell. His idols. His gods. And now, Walton. Then he shook his head violently and swore under his breath at himself, "God damn you!" The roar had gone. He had been watching Walton slack-jawed like some high school kid, and the roar in his own head had just gone. He jumped up, spikes on, and sprinted around the first turn, ignoring, not really seeing, Denton's bemused expression as he went by. When he slowed to a jog on the far side, calmer now, his jaw was set, his eyes fixed in a trance, and the orb rested inside a howling mindstorm. He did not realize that the figure flashing by on the turn had been Walton. Now Cassidy took off his sweat bottoms, jogged around, and left them at his bag. He kept the top on and jogged on. This was the way he always did it. They were getting ready to run off the high hurdles, the last race before the mile. "Third call for the mile run. All milers report to the starter." The last leap of his heart jounced him as he heard the announcement, but by now he was accustomed to the shock. He made no move for the starting line, nor did any of the other milers. The high hurdles hadn't even been run, and there would be several minutes of confusion afterward while the timers sorted things out. The milers knew all these ancient rhythms, so they kept doing their striders and jogging. The gun cracked for the highs, and they looked across the track at the race with the mildest sort of curiosity. After the hurdlers had swept past the finish line, the announcer was after them again. "All milers report to the starter immediately. Last call for the one-mile run." It no longer jolted him, because it was all jolt now. He barely heard the loudspeaker, such was the roar in his head. When he took off his sweat top, he realized he had not put on his racing singlet. He was still in the wet T-shirt. "God damn it! How the hell could I have..." Then he got control again, jogged rapidly over to his bag, and changed. There was still plenty of time, even though most of the milers were on the track milling around. The timers were in disarray from the previous race, and the starter was walking among the runners as Cassidy knew he would. "All right, gentlemen," he was saying. "All right, listen to the starting instructions, gentlemen." As the runners paced back and forth, jiggling and jumping up and down, avoiding eyes, gasping their little shallow gasps, shaking out legs that didn't need shaking, and generally living their last few seconds of torment. Cassidy jogged out among them, feeling feathery light now in just racing nylon and spikes. He felt as though he weighed about 10 pounds. He wore the white and blue Adidas 9.9s that had never been second. Cassidy, too, took up the jiggling and pacing. The announcer was making introductions, but no one seemed to be paying attention. Walton was in lane one, so naturally they started with the outside lane. All eyes were on just one person, the powerful-looking Kiwi in the all-black nylon with a little silver fern over the breast. There was polite applause for the Finn in lane three, but when the announcer started on the final introduction, He didn't get to the gold medals, the world records, the endless titles before the place was a madhouse. Everyone knew it all already. Walton jogged out a few steps and waved. Denton stood by the first turn in his navy blue USA team sweats, watching. You have to learn the little smile and wave, he thought. That's one part of it maybe you don't think about beforehand. I'll bet that's the last thing old John wants to be doing right now, even before a race like this. Cassidy thought, easy, easy, easy. Be careful through the turn and get through the first lap. Then start thinking. Easy, easy, easy. Save your goodies. All right, gentlemen, the starter was saying in his executioner's tone, gun hanging down at the end of his fluorescent orange sleeve. A two-command start, gentlemen. Take your marks and then the gun. Is that clear? All right, gentlemen, stand tall. Stand tall, gentlemen. The crowd hushed suddenly. High up in the stands, very nearly directly across from the starting post, Andrea sat beside the very excited umbrella man and thought, it's him. The starter was backing out from among them now, still saying, stand tall, gentlemen, stand tall. And Quentin Cassidy stood tall in the night as a very slight breeze brushed his burning face. At last, he thought, at last it is here. It is really here. The starter began backing off the track in quick little steps, raising his gun arm at the same time. For just an instant, Cassidy looked over to lane one and saw John Walton staring right back at him. Take your marks. Cassidy's heart tried to leap out through his thin, taut skin and hop into his wet hands. But outwardly it was all very calm, very serene, just as always, and it seemed to last a tiny forever, just like that, a snapshot of them all there on the curved parabola of a starting line, eight giant hearts attached to eight pairs of bellows-like lungs mounted on eight pairs of supercharged stilts. They were poised there on the edge of some howling vortex they had run 10,000 miles to get to. Now they had to run one more. Crack! There was the tiny little flutter during which he thought his legs were going to fail completely, but then they were away, out of their crouches and fairly bolting, bounding out and away, not even smoothly yet, burning off the first rush of excitement and fear. But here Cassidy found himself about 2 yards in front already, and probably right on schedule for his maniac 25-second 220. Standing on the inside of the curve, Denton flashed by and said quietly, "Tuck in." Cassidy tucked in. He didn't recognize the green singlet, but it occurred to him that it had to be the runner in lane two. Walton was obviously behind them somewhere, unworried and unrushed. Then Cassidy glanced again and recognized the Irishman. Of course! He had hardly paid attention to anyone else in the race. The first 220 went by as always, giddily, and as they flashed by the white post, someone gave them an unofficial split. 26-2! Yow! Too fast! No wonder Walton didn't hop right on up there. But there was no chance to look around. Cassidy could sense runners on his outside shoulder, and twice he felt someone clipping his heel. He was running almost abreast of the Irishman, sharing the lead, actually, but the real truth was that he was more surrounded than anything else. As they came out of the second turn, he dared a quick glance to the inside and saw Walton, striding comfortably, head down, watching the feet flashing by in front of him. All business. Okay, thought Cassidy, stay right there, right where you are. It was an untenable attitude, he knew, but at this moment, before it all got wild and bad, it was easy to entertain such facile delusions of control. The crowd shrieked as they passed the starting post in a knot. But did he hear that? Probably not. He thought he heard one single shout, "Go, Cassidy!" 56, 57, 58. They were going by the post. Denton, flashing by again on the inside, said quickly, 57.5, too fast. Remarkable, he said it almost in a conversational tone, but Cassidy heard it distinctly. All right, Bruce, it's too goddamn fast. What the hell am I supposed to do about it? The announcer was saying, O'Rourke, then Kaitainen, Harris, and John Walton of New Zealand. Then it started to come to him as it always did here. He usually felt it in the gut first, a slow, acid kind of strain, systems beginning to panic down there, intestines, other organs closing down for the duration, preparing for whatever dire project was underway. And the legs now started to get the first wave of lactic acid numbness, the start of a deep ache that would all too soon become the ambulatory paralysis of the final straightaway. Even this early, he was getting all the old feelings, thinking, God, here it is again. Back in it again, and I had forgotten completely what it was like. Forgotten altogether. Shoulders and arms starting now. Pay attention, goddammit! The orb bobbed gently, taking it all in, retaining it, keeping it quiet inside the steely interior, and allowing him to think. He concentrated on his task. Even from the far straightaway, he could hear the crowd grow uneasy and then erupt, but before he could react, he sensed a body coming up on his shoulder and then flinging by to take the lead. A roar came from across the field. Cassidy pondered calmly. Who was it? It wasn't Walton. A short runner in all red. Wisconsin? St. John's? He racked his brain but came up with nothing. Was he a rabbit or just some guy looking for a few seconds of glory, leading John Walton in a mile? Cassidy hung where he was all through the turn, coming into the home straight for the second time, then glanced back to the inside and saw Walton, this time a little more labored, but still running casually, eyes cast slightly downward, watching the feet in front of him. The roar was deafening as they went by, but this time he was sure he heard it. There was no mistake. Several voices called out, Go, Cassidy! 157, 158, 159. Then two things happened almost at once. First, Bruce Denton flashed by, said calmly, 157, good. And a split second after that, the crowd erupted again as a black-suited runner bolted by in a savage burst of speed. Walton, what the hell is he doing? Cassidy thought. The announcer, excited, came on. And now Walton has taken the lead from Harris as they went by the half in... Cassidy couldn't hear the rest. Jesus, what is he doing? Cassidy thought as he watched the black-suited figure easily slide by the runner in red and keep on, showing no sign of slowing down. Cassidy was really feeling it now, starting the third lap, the old intestine sliding down the leg extremis that comes at the precise middle of a race when it dawns on you that there is a long, melancholy way to go. But there was Walton, pulling away. Quentin Cassidy did not know it, of course, but here was the decision for all time, the decision that would lead him up the path to the higher callings or off on a side road to end up in the bushes somewhere. There was really no thinking to it. His face now set firmly in the race mask, showing nothing more than a detached, strained interest, he let out a surge and found himself fairly flying around the Irishman down the back straight. Red Shirt was already fading badly from his burst, and Cassidy was by him quickly, too. He pulled into lane one and thought, That was too fast. You could have done that better. But it was too late for recriminations. He set about hauling in the black suit in front of him, even now blending into the night, spikes flashing in a blur ahead. And this, from across the field, the calls, more of them, louder, most positive, beseeching now, Cassidy! Cassidy! The announcer, Walton of New Zealand with Kaitainen 7 yards back. His shoulders ached now with the heavy strain of lactic acid, so he pumped harder, concentrated on his form, trying to cover ground smoothly. Now was the time he wanted to be floating, covering ground with as little effort as possible, but he found himself straining just to hold pace. And Walton looked so easy. Was he of this earth? Could it really be this much of a joke to him, running this pace without a care in the world? Cassidy could not feel his legs, but that was all right. He was flying along in the night, concentrating so hard on the black-suited demon out there that he was actually surprised to hit the second turn. He cursed mentally when he found himself flung by his own momentum out into the second lane, then got it under control, leaned into the turn, and got back in rhythm. A stupid mistake, he thought, and it cost me 2 yards. but coming out of the turn into the straight, he felt it. He had contact. Walton had come back to him some, and he had contact from 5 yards back. And he had the power. He knew that, too, as they sped down the straight. Really feeling it now, the lactic acid aching through his body, but also starting the build-up, getting excited knowing that this time it would not be long, that it wasn't going to go on forever at all. Down past the stands, and this time Cassidy heard, unbelieving, what they were chanting as the two figures went by the white starting post. Cassaday! 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 Even the announcer no longer played the game. It's Walton followed by Cassidy of Southeastern. Dick Doobie, nearly blind with rage, blood vessels standing out on his soft red face, jumped up from his seat in the officials section and started out the gate onto the track to do God only knew what when he ran smack into the really quite startlingly muscled arm of Mike Mobley that was stretched across the opening, his huge hand holding the far post in a death grip. Mobley challenged him for an instant with a gaze full of contempt and pity. Then the giant turned back to the race and the chant. Cassaday! 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 His face ashen, Doobie slumped into the nearest seat he could find. Up in the press box in icy silence, Stephen C. Prigman turned to look at the gentlemen of the press, some of whom waited for his reaction. He smiled ruefully, turned back to the race. And Denton flashed by now. 255 flat. Wait. Then the gun. Crack! And the hair on the back of his neck standing up as it always did. Cassidy thought, 400 yards to go. Jesus God, what a cost just to be here, and he's slipping away. If I could just hold him now, he's been flat out for... But Walton was not flat out at all. He suddenly looked back at Cassidy, and Cassidy thought he saw a tiny flicker in those hard eyes. Surprise. Not concern, just a mild kind of surprise. And that followed by a little burst so powerful and quick it broke Cassidy's heart. God, how can he do that? Quentin Cassidy, sadly now, was starting to tie up halfway down the back straight, and all he could think was, son of a bitch, what has he been doing running from the front? He never does that. Now Cassidy's arms and shoulders were getting worse and worse as the orbs strained and bounced around inside, trying to hold it all together. Cassidy, feeling now the process of his form starting to degenerate involuntarily, wanly remarked to himself that this must be how death is. And look how easy, dear God, he looks up there. So this is how it is. This is exactly how it is, how he beats you and beats you and beats you. She had stood by with everyone else the last time, and though she knew Umbrella Man was unobtrusively observing her reactions now, she studied Cassidy's face when he went by and saw in it the total dispassionate look of the runner at his toil, alert but not excited, full of strain and some unnamed misery, but so obviously showing no emotion, masking darker secrets. What was it he had said about demons? She had some idea of what Cassidy and Walton were experiencing because the other runners, some 20 yards behind, did not hold it as well as these two. Walton to her looked simply intimidating, as if he had been born at full stride. His torso was powerful for a runner, and his every stride suggested merciless strength held in reserve. He was haughty in his power, and it was somehow chilling to watch. But then she had looked at Quentin Cassidy, saw the same objective, emotionless look about him, watched the sleek, machine-like workings of legs that were longer than Walton's, and suddenly she had seen him from a different perspective. He, too, looked intimidating. And something very deep inside her stirred as she realized that she was, after all, frightened for him, for this task he had taken upon himself. Her eyes had flooded, and she stood there in her confusion and turmoil, not caring that Umbrella Man was staring at her. Cassaday! 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 He was starting to get the white haze, even this early. It would be very bad when it all caught up, but of course, that was no consideration now. Come on, you son of a bitch, he thought, but he knew he was just hanging on. It was all going slowly downhill, and Walton had about 8 yards on him still. Cassidy could feel the muscles in his neck start to tighten, pulling his lower lip downward into an ugly grimace. He knew this was one of the last signs, this death sneer. "So this is what happens. You just don't get him, that's all. The son of a bitch just keeps on going, and it ends, and you don't get him ever." Cassidy adjusted his lean a little forward. That seemed to help some, but the neck was getting tighter, and he felt his arms beginning to stiffen. By the time they got out of the turn and into the last straight, he knew they would be really bad. All down the back straight, Cassidy tried to reel him in, but it was no good. 8 yards! 8 yards! 8 yards! The strain was apparent to those close to the track. On the exhale breath, he made little gasps. Gah! 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 His eyes were starting to squeeze up shut, but he could hardly see through the white haze anyway. The chant roared across the field, beseeching, hopeful, frenzied. Cassidy! 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 Shut up! Shut up! I'm not your goddamn hero! All down the back straight, he stared at the fleeing black suit through the wrinkled slits his eyes had become, stared at the black suit and wished they would all leave him alone. Just leave him the hell alone with his misery and defeat. That's when he saw it. Almost imperceptible, but there it was just the same. The left shoulder dipped suddenly, then the right leg shot out a little farther than usual, and that was it. Back to normal stride. Walton was tying up too. So that's the way it is. Not so casual after all. Cassidy bore down, and finally began reeling him in. All during the final turn, all the way around, he pulled him in, inch by inch, as his mouth was drawn more and more into the ugly grimace by the spastic neck muscles. Inch by inch, the black suit came back until finally they broke clear of the turn, and there it was. John Walton was 3 feet ahead of him, with 110 yards of tartan stretching out in front of them to the finish line. There was utter pandemonium in the stands as the chant degenerated into a howling, shrieking din. Quentin Cassidy moved out to the second lane, the lane of high hopes, and ran out the rest of the life in him. 37. A Stiller Town. All through the last 50 yards he had looked through the 2 fogged slits of windows at the howling slow-motion nightmare going on around him as his body rigged up in true fashion, getting the jaw-shoulder lock and the sideways final straight fade, and he began to lose all semblance of control. He peered out at all this as the orb was about to burst, letting all the poison flood out, peered at it and quite calmly wondered, when will it all end? He felt more than saw Walton come back up to his shoulder, entertained an idle curiosity about who would get it, but then went back to wistfully concentrating on those green inches of tartan passing slowly, slowly beneath his feet. The last 10 yards his body was a solid block of lactic acid, with those straining neck muscles pulling his lip down and his back arched, trapezia trying to pull him over backward. And all the way Quentin Cassidy was telling himself, "Not now. It hurts, but go all the way through. Do not stop until you are past it. You cannot afford to give the son of a bitch anything. So hold it, hold it, hold it, Jesus Christ, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it!" Finally, with a scream and a violent wrenching motion, he shook himself loose from this terrible force that gripped him, made himself bend into a semblance of a lean, and it was over. Or at least he thought it was over, if it was not all some bad dream, and he is gasping, simply wrenching air from around him, feeling death surely imminent here beside him, crying and going hands to knees, stumbling, "Please leave me, please, I don't want, please, I need to breathe." And then Denton has him around the waist and is lifting him up off the ground, "Please, Bruce, put me down, I can't breathe." But Denton is taking him off, away from them, dragging the tall, brown, limp doll which apparently cannot stand on its own, holding him up painfully and saying, "Remember it, Quentin. God damn you better remember it, because it doesn't ever get any better. Are you listening to me, God damn you?" And Cassidy forcing his eyes open finally and seeing Denton through the white haze and seeing that he is crying too.
Oh, Bruce, I'm listening. Please let me go. Jesus, it hurts. And Denton lets him go, hands to knees, to pray to the runner's finish line god. But Denton leans over and whispers, 3:52.5, Cass. He kicked from 500 yards out, but it was you, Quentin Cassidy. It was you all the way. You know you beat him, don't you, Quentin, goddammit? But Cassidy can't do anything but hold his knees and make his little gagging noises and nod, wishing everyone would just leave him the hell alone so he could see if he was going to die. Walton walks by and they touch hands. Walton regards Cassidy with curiosity but no fear. He nods to Denton.
Bruce, he says.
John. This is no game for upstarts or big surprises, and Walton's look is clearly more of curiosity than anything else. There will be time, his eyes say, time for decisions and revisions.
Light a mate,
he says to Quentin Cassidy, a respectful nod to Denton, and he is gone.
Later, Cassidy says to himself. When, after the countless flashes of cameras and the rude pushing, the well-wishing and the endless questions, still wanting to know the secret, after all of that he finally got away from them and talked with Bruce Denton quietly for a few moments. He pulled the zipper up all the way on the sweat top against the evening chill and stepped out onto the track as those remaining in the bleachers roared. Quentin Cassidy looked up, gave a little smile and wave, and thought, I have nowhere to go. It was then that Bruce Denton turned with a sigh and walked alone toward the gate, thinking that Quentin Cassidy's smile looked sad indeed. 38. A Runner. The young man walked steadily through the far turn, the darkest part of the track, and entered the final straightaway. Here, he thought, it is usually all over. Just a matter of throwing what is left into it. It would be exciting to the onlookers, perhaps, but the runners would be calmly playing it out. During the second and third laps, he had tried to conjure up the old feeling of despair and pain, but as always, could not quite get it. It had to be experienced, not remembered. Now he was walking the last 50 yards, unconsciously swinging his arms a little more vigorously, trying to conjure up some of that helpless, frozen broth of the last few yards, when the arms and shoulders, legs and hips all seemed to bind themselves up together, and the jaw locks into the tight grimace as if in supplication, and all of life is reduced to a simple desperation, a pleading for the last pathetic twitch from simple clay. How well he knew these things. Then he was by the post, telling himself for the last 5 yards, go through it, go all the way through it. He stopped and looked around. The pain would catch you here, of course. The orb would shatter as soon as you crossed the line, and it would overwhelm you for those first few seconds. That, of all the feelings, was the one that your mind protected you from the most. Later, you wouldn't even be able to get a hint of it. But he supposed that, even as bad as it was then, there must be some kind of pleasure mixed in with it, some desperate relief. Joy, perhaps, in knowing that it was over one more time, with nothing held back. He took several deep breaths of the warm September air, and then walked to the infield to get his travel bag. He looked around once more at the vaulting pits, the oblong sandbox of the horizontal jumpers, the concrete rings for the weight men, and finally back at the starting post. His eyes then took in the track, slowly following the rubberized surface all the way around the first turn, down the long, lonely back straight past the 220 post, around the far turn, and then back up the final straight to the finish post, where he had long ago beaten the great John Walton. Uncomplicated dimensions that had, for some years now, defined his life. A quarter of a mile that he knew by the inches. There was much to be left behind here, he thought, but I can live with that. He walked straight across the infield, across the track, and out the gate, leaving the joggers to their nightly toil. The moths still worried the streetlight. The young man stopped momentarily amid the dancing insect shadows and opened the small travel bag. He reached around under the passport, clothes, and toilet articles until he found it. He opened the flat, thin, oblong box under the streetlight and looked at it once more. The heavy, round disc reposed against pink satin, its thick purple ribbon curling up and behind the soft material. The writing around the edge was in Greek, but the general import was clear enough. In the pale light, the silver metal glowed dully. It no longer stabbed at him. "This I can live with, too," he thought, "primarily because I no longer have any say in the matter." He smiled faintly, closed the box, and replaced it in the bottom of the bag. He turned without looking back and walked away from the track. There was a very old, gnarled tree somewhere he wanted to find, and then he would be on his way. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Once a Runner by John L. Parker, Jr. Copyright 1978 and 1990 by John L. Parker. Read by Patrick Lawler. Performance copyright 2009 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.